Welcome back to First Assist GU Oncology Unpacked. I'm your host, Taylor Goodstein, and my guest this week is Dr. Pritesh Patel, who is an associate professor of radiation oncology at Emory University. He specializes in GI and GU malignancies. So welcome to the show, Dr. Patel, and thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Taylor. Thanks so much for having me.
So this week, we're going to talk about radiation and prostate cancer, which is a very big topic. But I think for our learners, the best place to start would be the definitions of what we're talking about when it comes to radiation and prostate cancer.
Sure. Yeah. So, broadly speaking, we describe ionizing radiation as basically some way of delivering a radiation exposure to generate DNA damage and kill prostate cancer cells. The common ways that we use that now, of course, is a beam type of a treatment, which is broadly called external beam radiation. The number of treatments we give, the precision we use in delivering that type of treatment, in some cases then can categorize the treatment differently. So a common way that we now treat is something called SBRT. This is still a beam form of external radiation. It's just that we can concentrate the radiation dose a little bit better than we used to, and we can target it well. And now we've condensed the radiation schedule down to just 5 treatments. So when we say SBRT, really that's what we mean. It's a beam treatment, and it's just 5 visits for the patient to be treated with a beam form of treatment. The other common schedules, 28 daily treatments is a common one. And in some cases, maybe a longer schedule, 38 fractions, or maybe even up to 44 fractions. I think what we've seen over time, though, is we've been doing trials looking at non-inferiority of more convenient treatment schedules. And so we've gone from longer schedules to 28. And now we've got lots of data supporting the use of just 5 SBRT treatments, which looks quite good for most prostate cancer. So that's a really big area of growth, I think, in the United States, at least. When we talk about beam, I think for the most part, we're talking about photon or X-ray radiation, but proton radiation is another way to give a beam therapy. And so really everything else is the same, the number of treatments, the way that I do a design or target what I want to target, all of that is identical, whether I'm using an X-ray or a proton approach. The machine and the physics of the treatment, of course, are a little bit different. The proton beam can go in and stop, as opposed to an X-ray beam, which travels all the way through. And so this gives us an opportunity to maybe concentrate even a little bit more, the intended exposure to the prostate and in some cases the at-risk lymph nodes, and eliminate some of the scatter exposure you might see from an X-ray beam that's exiting. So that's proton radiation. All the same schedules apply, 5, 28, or longer. And everything else is usually the same, too. So fiducial markers are often placed before a beam treatment. Rectal spacers are often used in appropriate candidates for beam therapies. And then the other big one is called brachytherapy. Brachytherapy is basically an implantation of a radioactive source into the prostate. There's 2 kind of broad categories. There's the seed procedure, which is a permanent implant of iodine or palladium seeds. It's a one-time procedure. We do these, of course, in conjunction with the urologist. Typically, we're co-surgeons as we do this. Most often ultrasound guided, where with the low dose rate or LDR brachytherapy, we're implanting these seeds permanently, basically all around the prostate. And then there's another form of therapy called high dose rate or HDR brachytherapy. And this is a little bit different in that we put catheters into the prostate. We send a radioactive source on a wire into those catheters, and we can actually deliver the whole treatment in about 20 minutes and then remove the radioactive source. So that's the other way that brachytherapy can be delivered. So, and then in some cases, we use a combination of these treatments as well. So in more favorable risk cancers, typically you just need one type of treatment. And then as you go to more intermediate and high-risk cancers, we start to see better outcomes in some cases when we do a combination. And by that, I mean a brachy treatment and then a beam therapy or a combination.
That's great. That gives us an awesome starting point. When I'm reading a lot of these papers, I see so many different, letters being thrown around. I see SBRT, I see IMRT, I see IGRT. What is the difference between those things? Or Sabers up there as well? Like,
yeah,
how do
yeah,
I
yeah.
know what everyone's talking about?
Right. That's great. No, it's a great question. I take it for granted because I see this every day. So SBRT and Saber are synonymous. And again, it's a beam, that's a beam therapy that's just five fractions. Okay. And in some cases, we're testing if we can do it even faster than that, maybe fewer visits even. So that's SBRT or SABR, Saber. IMRT stands for intensity modulated radiation therapy. This is the standard of care. There's no other way basically that this treatment is delivered at this point. And that's this other schedules I mentioned, 20, 28, 38, 44, the longer schedules, anything more than five basically would be categorized as IMRT, intensity modulated radiation, or IMPT, which would be intensity modulated proton therapy. Okay. And then IGRT stands for image guided radiation therapy. And this is also another standard of care that should be available across the board. We place fiducial markers because right before the treatment is delivered, all the modern radiation machines now can generate an image directly on the patient while they're laying there in the treatment position. We can make plain x-rays, which is often done. Obviously, you can see metallic fiducial markers in that case. We can also make what's called a cone beam CT, which is, a CT scan of the pelvis. And both of these things are done to guide the radiation to the right place. So we're, the physician and the radiation therapist that we work with essentially are making fine-tuned adjustments on the day of, immediately prior to delivering the treatment.
Do you consider like a high-dose brachytherapy to be an IGRT because you're using an ultrasound to guide the placement of your catheters, or is that not fair to say?
Yeah, no, I think it's quite fair to say, maybe at this point, almost everything we do is image-guided, and that's true outside of radiation oncology too, of course. We've incorporated imaging everywhere. So IGRT, that acronym in particular, really, when we say it, we're talking about to guide a beam treatment because it's happening sort of right at that minute, right before the treatment's delivered. And it translates into me having a higher confidence that we're going to be able to target what we want to target accurately. And so that means if I'm going to add a little bit of uncertainty margin around the prostate, now if I know I can see it better, maybe I'm going to start shrinking that margin, meaning the side effects might get better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we're looking at the big buckets, we have like IGRT is kind of everything, but most specifically referred to beam therapy. And then SBRT is a type of IMRT that is specifically referring to that hypofractionated course. Five. And I think this was something I found confusing because hypofractionated, the word hypo to me means less.
Yeah.
And it's less treatments, but it's the same amount of radiation. It's delivered in a higher dose. Is that correct to say?
Yes, that's a great point. Yeah. When we say hypofractionation, we are comparing to the alternative, which is conventional fractionation, which was the much longer treatment courses, 7-8 weeks of radiation. So hypofractionation, there are a couple different options for that, but basically giving a little bit more radiation per day, shrinking the number of visits that are required, but delivering the same biological effect. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's iso-effective, but just a fewer number of treatments. And then SBRT, we sometimes refer to as extreme hypofractionation because we've taken it from 20 or 28 all the way down to 5.
Got it. And the big limitation on, if we look at the way that radiation oncology has changed over time, the reason why all those fractions were spaced out was because of concern for side effects. And as we get better, I'd imagine we're learning that you can give higher and higher doses over a shorter period of time because we've gotten better at managing those side effects. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's it. There are some technical, improvements in the way the radiation is calculated and designed. The image guidance is improved dramatically. So, you'll be surprised if I show you one of these cone beam CTs. And a lot of times it looks like a diagnostic CT. I mean, you really can make out all the anatomy and make adjustments to get the prostate directly in the crosshair, so to speak. And so that, I think, is the IGRT is really helped us And, you know, what's coming next is, again, with the improvements in things like AI and computing speed and power, you know, there's already a number of machines available where you can actually put a patient on the table, take that picture, take a cone beam CT, and make a whole new radiation plan right there, right then, based on exactly where the prostate and the rectum and the bladder might be that minute.
That's
called adaptive radiation.
Wow.
So that's being done already. That's a standard of care. A number of institutions around the United States have been doing this now for some time. You know, and that's the kind of thing we expect to see more and more of.
I also remember you, when I was in your clinic, you telling me something about hypofractionation, the like higher amount of radiation given at one time, that there are certain like types of cancer that respond, like biologically behave, like, I guess I would say better, but technically they're being killed more, so that's worse for the cancer, with that specific schedule, and that prostate is one of those.
That's right. Yes. Your most rapidly proliferating epithelial malignancies respond very well to fractionated course of radiation. And the reason we like fractionation is because it allows the normal tissues a chance to recover. So when radiation first started, when we didn't have IGRT or IMRT or these fancy acronyms, you know, we had to treat bigger areas. And so it really made sense to fractionate because that allowed us to minimize the normal tissue side effect while still, you know, getting the cancer kill against, you know, whatever it was we were treating. Then we learned that some cancers respond, you know, well to that fractionated approach, but some you might even get a bigger biological effect or a better cell kill if you give more at once. It's something in radiation oncology that's called the alpha-beta ratio. So this just describes on the cell survival curve, you know, how it responds, the cancer cell survival assay looks with when you compare a fractionated course or a more hypofractionated course. So for prostate cancer, we've always known that hypofractionation should lead to, you know, better cell kill. And so that may be, you know, why we're seeing, you know, really good outcomes with SBRT. And the thing that's changed is now we can geographically constrain where the radiation goes. So that part allows us to limit the side effects and achieve hypofractionation in prostate cancer. And, you know, and probably the most extreme form of hypofractionation is HDR. Brachytherapy.
Right.
That's the most all at once.
Because that's radiation within like a 20-minute period of time. And how many total treatments does the patient typically get?
If it's HDR therapy alone, it's just two. And they're usually a week or two apart.
Got it. So I did want to talk a little bit about what the experience is like for the patient to go through radiation. So let's say you sign somebody up for a course of SBRT. What do those visits look like? You know, that first visit where they get their fiducials and then the subsequent visits when they're getting treated.
Yeah, great. Great question. So, yeah, after we've, you know, talked through all the options, if we know we're ready to go, usually what I tell the patients is, okay, so the next time you're going to see me is for usually an in-office procedure where we're going to be placing the three fiducial markers. And it's variable how many you can place. I typically place three. And again, in appropriate candidates, we use a rectal spacer, although neither of those things are actually required. And there's plenty of ways to deliver radiation where you can bypass the procedure completely. For example, if you have one of these adaptive machines, maybe you don't need either of those things, you know? So in our practice, we typically do the procedure. So the procedure can be done either in the OR, in the ASC, or in clinic. You can give conscious sedation, which we sometimes do. It's not absolutely necessary. Patients are in dorsal lithotomy. We use the standard sort of local anesthesia in the skin. It's a transperineal approach, so different than a standard prostate biopsy. You know, when we talk about it, the patients always ask me, well, how does it compare to a prostate biopsy? I was like, it's kind of similar, except for you're usually laying on your back instead of your side. I am still using a rectal ultrasound, which is similar. And then the needles, instead of going through the rectum, are going through the skin. So, you know, that's how they get set up. It's maybe 15 minutes. It's quite fast. You know, the most uncomfortable part is just getting the local anesthetic in. I typically use, you know, anesthetize the skin and then the apex of the prostate. And then thereafter, we have preloaded needles that have fiducial markers in them. And there are different materials that are used. Gold is common. We use graphite as well in some cases. And then, you know, you're really looking for three safe places in the prostate when you place that. Again, it's a transperineal approach. I'm typically doing right base, right apex, left mid. The whole point of that procedure is so that I can see and triangulate the position of the prostate on just a plain x-ray of the pelvis. We typically do an AP and a lateral x-ray. So I don't want the markers blocking each other. So I'm looking for to be able to see them, all three of them on both sets of images. And then after that, that's maybe 5 minutes. And then the rest of the 10 minutes or so is placing the rectal spacer. The other number of industry partners that have developed these spacers and have very specific guidance, you know, on the optimal technique certainly takes some practice. But as you get, I think, more accustomed to interpreting the ultrasound, finding that space between the prostate and rectum, in some cases doing a hydrodissection, you know, in some cases not, then you've got some options in terms of whether you use, you know, just a product that's just a hydrogel that doesn't mix, or a different product that that mixes and then fills in the space.
And then after that, when do they get their first treatment? Is it usually a week later, or can they start right away?
I think there's variability in what happens around the United States. I think some places will do, before you can get radiation treatment, we have to do what's called a simulation. So the simulation now is what comes next. And this can be a CT or an MRI, or a CT and an MRI. And basically, we want now a picture of the fiducial markers, the prostate, the rectal spacer. And we tell the patients that they need to be in the treatment position. And what that means for a prostate cancer patient is typically just supine, leg straight. We'll build some leg immobilizers so that they can be in a consistent position each day. We put some marks on their skin to sort of help us get a starting point as to where they should be set up under the machine. And then importantly, we always remind them that we want a full bladder and an empty rectum when you come for treatment. And basically what that does is deflect some of the bowel structures away from the prostate and obviously reduce the rectal exposure if it's not too full. So we're really looking for a consistent setup such that that can be replicated every single day. So we go through these instructions and we do a CT simulation, make these immobilization devices. That takes maybe an hour. Again, some patients also get an MRI simulation either that day, or we can even use the diagnostic MRI from before and overlay it or fuse it with the CT sim that we do. And then the patients go home. Then it takes, I would say, a minimum of probably 5 business days to get the treatment prepared and ready. This is an area where there's a lot of interest in AI and speeding this up, doing this faster. But basically, we're segmenting all the normal anatomy. We're adding those margins based on what the plan is in terms of how the treatment's going to be localized and delivered. And then we're doing calculations to kind of map out where the radiation exposure is going to be in the body. The radiation oncologist approves all of this by looking at how well is the prostate covered, how well are we avoiding the rectum and the bladder and the penile bulb and the other normal structures. And once that's all approved, then the physics team does quality assurance. So this has to be done after hours. We basically put the machine through the steps that would be involved with delivering this treatment. We measure what comes out of the machine to make sure it's precise. And once all of that is approved, then the patient can start. And so that's why it takes many, many days. Yep. And then, you know, usually at our institution, the day they get that simulation, we give them a date to come and start. Usually, again, it's 5 to 7 business days later.
And so let's say they're doing their 5 doses of SBRT. They start on a Thursday. They'll skip over the weekend and kind of just resume. They'll go straight through. It's like Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then they're done.
I think it's probably most common to do every other day for the treatments with SBRT. And we do SBRT, you know, for all different cancers all over the body. So I would say it's probably more common to do the treatment every other day, which means it takes a week and a half. But there are plenty of experiences where doing it every day is also possible. So I think, you know, at our institution, our patients are going to be asked to come every other day.
Got it. And then when they come in, that treatment, you know, sitting in the machine, getting it done, it's, you know, 30 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's about right. You know, as soon as you're called and you lay under this machine, we start with getting those skin marks in the right spot. Then we take the IGRT image, make a little fine tune adjustment to get the prostate, you know, perfectly aligned. For SBRT, we do the CT as well. A physician is called to the machine to verify all the anatomy. So we're looking at rectal filling and bladder filling and making sure everything is aligned. And we think the dose is going to be delivered in the way that we planned. And once that's approved, the beam delivery is, number one, is totally painless. Number two, that probably only takes 2 or 3 minutes. You know, the machine just sort of travels around the patient. It doesn't touch them. It's not closed in. There's no claustrophobia. So all told, 30 to 45 minutes in and out the door.
Wow. And so if a patient does come in and they have an empty bladder or, you know, a full rectum, is that somebody that you're like, let's skip today's dose and get you back in tomorrow?
Right. Yeah. It's not common, but if the anatomy really looks different from what we expected, you know, we have a couple options. If you have an adaptive machine, you can adapt on the fly. You could recalculate the radiation to take that into account. In a lot of cases, what we do is say, okay, you don't have to go home. Let's just get you off the table. We'll treat the next patient, you know, while you drink another bottle of water.
Got it.
Let your bladder fill.
The old water trick.
Yeah. I will tell you that that part of it, the prep and getting the bladder just right and getting the having a bowel movement every day and getting the rectum empty, that is actually a pretty large source of anxiety for prostate cancer radiation patients. You know, they're often together in the waiting area. They talk about it. You know, we can't be perfectly on time with the time the treatment's going to be available for them. So we want a full bladder. You know, these are patients with irritated prostates.
Right.
And have trouble with urgency, and they're holding their bladders, and sometimes they've got to pee and then fill up again. And it's an ongoing discussion. And, I tell the patients, doesn't have to be perfect. Do the best you can. But yeah, it may be something where we've got to try for a second time in a day. And that's okay. That happens.
So that kind of brings me to the next question I have, which is which patients you don't recommend hypofractionation for, or maybe like differentiating from a patient perspective. We'll get into a cancer perspective, but from a patient perspective, who might be better for regular, you know, fractionation versus brachytherapy in terms of, you know, symptoms and things like that?
There are a couple comorbidities, you know, where radiation toxicity may be really exaggerated. Somebody with active inflammatory bowel disease, for example, you know, most of those cases, I would say, let's see if there's a way for you to have surgery, you know, and skip radiation altogether. You know, there are a couple others like that, but that's probably the most common. The other patients that, you know, I'm careful with are those that have pretty significant urinary toxicity or comorbidity at baseline. So patients that are already on near maximal medical therapy and, you know, still have an AUA score that's in the 20s, maybe 30s, you know, those are the patients where that type of obstructive uropathy is, you know, basically exactly what the radiation's likely to exacerbate. And we run the risk of running into retention in some cases. And so, you know, I think there's a dogma in radiation oncology that hypofractionation or extreme hypofractionation may worsen the risk of something like that happening. You know, I think more and more data, especially related to SBRT, are coming out showing, you know, the urinary toxicity looks basically the same.
So, oh, wow.
I think, you know, that dogma is being challenged. But those are maybe the few patients where I'll say, you know, the data are a little mixed on this, but maybe in your case, it makes sense to stretch out the radiation a little bit where maybe we should do 20 or in some cases, maybe we'll do 38, you know, and I've got a few men on treatment now where that's the case. You know, but that's probably the main consideration. I have, you know, I don't have a hard and fast cutoff for brachytherapy, but if your AUA scores near 20 or in the 20s and you're already on maximal medical therapy, you probably don't want to have brachytherapy because you could end up with a much more significant permanent, you know, urinary toxicity, which could include self-cath. But that's really obviously any grade 3 toxicity we want to stay away from. So that urinary probably is the main one. The other is the median lobe. So a very enlarged median lobe that's extending into the bladder lumen in general is a contraindication to brachy. We can treat those with external beam. Some of the trials that have been done in SBRT have limited the prostate size to say something like 100 cc's or less. And that might be another reason to maybe lean towards a hypofractionation and not SBRT if you've got somebody, you know, with one of these really large median lobes. And sometimes, surprisingly, they have minimal urinary symptoms, you know, but there's a median lobe that's touching the dome of the bladder, you know, and we treat all of that. So those are another case where I'd probably aim for a more fractionated treatment.
Do you have a prostate size limit or consideration for prostate size? I know we talked a little bit about median lobe.
Yeah. Not really. And, you know, I think for brachytherapy, there's a, you know, kind of a, again, a dogma that 60 cc's is around the cutoff. And maybe that's the case for the LDR prostate brachy, which is the permanent seats. But for the HDR, I mean, I found that to be a little, you know, pretty flexible in who I could treat. As again, as long as there's not median lobe in the bladder lumen, we've treated HDR as big as 100, 120 cc's. And for external beam, there's really no limit, you know, I think.
Got it.
But it's always a discussion about if you do have really significant urinary symptoms here at baseline, is it possible that surgery, you know, a prostatectomy will help you with both of these problems?
Right.
Your cancer and your urinary symptoms.
Right.
And so that's another, you know, I think another case where sometimes we'll say maybe it's just a better idea for you to avoid radiation.
Now, I want to get into talking about the different, you know, risk groups for prostate cancer. Before I do that, though, one quick question. When you were talking about the simulation session and how sometimes you use MRIs or perhaps the patient's diagnostic MRI, does that mean that you are you doing any sort of aiming specifically around PIRADS lesions? If a patient has a dominant PIRADS lesion, will you specifically target more radiation to that area?
Yeah, that's a great question, Taylor. So, I think what we're learning is that you know, sort of the more aggressive biology does seem to respond better to more dose, or more biological radiation dose. And so, in the rare low risk patient who just wants to be treated, I would almost certainly never do that. In a favorable intermediate risk case, probably not. But then as we start to get to, you know, the grade group three and above, nowadays we usually have a really good MRI and we usually have a PSMA PET scan as well. So the design of the radiation, you know, always incorporates all of that diagnostic imaging. So we fuse all these scans together in our treatment planning scans. And so the MRI is overlaid. Again, it could be diagnostic or it could be one that I got the day that I did the procedure, which is the way I usually do it. The PET scan is also overlaid. And so, yeah, we get the prostate itself mapped out, but nowadays we can get the lesion or lesions mapped out as well. And when it's safe, meaning we can keep the normal organs within tolerance, we do aim to give a higher dose in those areas when we can. This is, I think, a growing area of interest. We have randomized evidence that suggests that at least biochemical control is improved when you do that. And there's there are a number of trials looking at brachytherapy boosts, which also suggest the same, which is the same thing, dose escalation in the setting of, you know, biologically aggressive disease. So we're able to do this now with brachy, and we can, you know, we're getting better and better at doing it with a beam form of radiation as well. So more and more, my SBRT cases have the whole prostate getting one dose, and then the little, you know, the tumor area plus margin getting up.
Wow. That's great. That's great. You know, we're getting more focused medicine. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the risk group. So obviously a low risk patient, this is somebody that we would all agree should be on active surveillance, not getting treated. But if you have a patient that comes who's adamant about being treated, you know, you may not even, you say, go to someone else, I'm not going to do that. But would you, you know, what radiation would you do for them if you were to treat that person?
Yeah, you know, I think the first thing is, you're exactly right. I mean, I think active surveillance is always sort of the number one recommendation. There are people that just can't sleep at night, you know, and I tell them, you know, if that's the way that you feel about this, let's find the treatment that aligns, you know, with your priorities. Sometimes that's surgery. Sometimes it's radiation. If we're going to do radiation, it's definitely radiation alone, one form, no hormone therapy. And we pick the most appropriate one, you know, based on some of those other factors that we described. So the most convenient treatment that's going to that's appropriate for the patient, I think is what we're going to typically land on. Nowadays, it's often SBRT, and sometimes it's brachy. You do have to think about anesthesia risk and some of that when it comes
right.
to that. But yeah, something that's usually not a drawn out treatment and not a combination therapy.
Got it. So low risk, check that box. Okay, let's move on to the more interesting kind of intermediate risk patient. So we've got our favorable intermediate risk patient coming in. What do they qualify for?
Yeah, we've got, this is where it gets very interesting, as you said, and these are tend to be long conversations now in a radiation oncology clinic. The intermediate risk group is really the group where we start to see a benefit of combination androgen deprivation. And where that cutoff is in terms of who's going to benefit and who's not and how much benefit is something where, thankfully, we have a lot of new data coming out. And we have new diagnostic tools like genomic classifiers. There's an AI tool, as you know, of called Artera, that can help risk stratify and prognosticate, in addition to what we do standardly, which is, PSA, Gleason score, and the MECO classification. So, I look at all of those things. When we are, let's say that we've done, number of these tests, interpreting them, also is an area of active research. How do we incorporate the genomic classifier with the rest of the clinical variables? Let's just say that we've got that figured out. When we place somebody in the favorable intermediate risk category, in general, I think most of us believe that radiation alone is likely to be an appropriate choice. We did have a large study done in intermediate risk cancers, which were both favorable and unfavorable, where we looked at would a short course of androgen deprivation lead to a survival benefit? And so post hoc analyses of historical data suggested that benefit is mostly in the unfavorable intermediate risk population. And the benefit of ADT, maybe the absolute benefit, let's say, is less in the favorable intermediate risk population.
Right.
So that's the discussion of what are the side effects of the addition of hormone therapy and how much does it improve, for example, the risk of distant metastasis, right? So if we already have a really low risk of metastasis, how much is it helping us? And there are many patients who come in the door with one core of, grade group two and a low PSA and a low Decipher, and they want to have hormone therapy because it is an appropriate option in all intermediate risk disease. And I think that's very appropriate. That's why these conversations can take time.
Got it. Are you using the new AI Artera? I know that's made it into guidelines as an option. What patients are you using that for, if you are?
Yeah, I think the easiest one, there are two cases to me that are make the most sense to me and seem easiest right now to deploy in clinic. One is the favorable intermediate risk patient who's considering active surveillance. In that case, I think we would all agree we want to see some type of a genomic classifier that shows a favorable prognosis. I think that one to me is pretty clear. The others are the ones that are sort of on the fence between favorable and unfavorable intermediate risk. So the PSA of 10.5 and those that have just around 50% of their cores positive or something like this, where you really could go either way with the clinical designation of favorable or unfavorable intermediate. So those are cases where, you might use one of these new tests as a tiebreaker. It is important to note that the genomic classifiers really only look at the genetics, of the cancer, whereas the AI classifier incorporates digital images of the pathology, but also the other clinical variables. So that you do get something.
Got it.
Different, and in some cases they could be discordant. In fact, they often are, and that can make things very confusing. So I really do try to stick with one or the other and not both. Then we're incorporating that. These tests give us a really nice description of the prognost, the assessment or the the prognosis for distant metastasis. And that's the number I think we use most from those reports to help sort of assess the benefit of hormone therapy and guide the patients in making that decision.
Are you usually mostly using that to adjudicate yes to no, yes or no hormone therapy, or do you use that ever to adjudicate the length of time that you keep someone on hormone therapy?
Yeah, great question. So these are all things that are being looked at in clinical trial today. So we just completed a study or we're completing a study that uses one of the genomic classifiers, essentially when the risk, genomic risk is low, you know, to leave out hormone therapy, you know, basically randomizing to de-escalation.
Is that Decipher? Sorry to interrupt.
That one, that study uses Decipher.
Okay. Right.
Yep. And then when the genomic risk is high, that same study randomizes men to an intensification of hormone therapy, so adding an antiandrogen. In general, in the intermediate risk group, we tend to stick with 4 to 6 months of hormone therapy, and we rarely would ever do it longer than that. You know, historical data really suggested that, you know, that's probably enough, and there's not as much of a benefit when you go to long-term androgen deprivation in the intermediate risk group. Okay. And the same thing's happening in the high-risk patients, where we're using these classifiers to think about who can de-escalate, who needs maybe an escalation in the ADT.
And what do you usually do as the timing for starting your ADT relative to starting radiation?
Yeah, great question. I think it's you know, another one where there are a number of ways that this can be done that are appropriate. So you could start the hormone therapy and the radiation, you know, right away, concurrently almost. I think many of us intend to purposefully give at least a short course of the hormone therapy sort of neoadjuvantly before we come in with the concurrent radiation. We get, you know, really two kind of side benefits there. Number one, there does seem to be maybe some radiosensitization when you're really at a castrate level of testosterone. And then number two, we get downsizing of the prostate gland, you know, and so if you wait, you know, you can just technically make the radiation plan maybe a little more favorable by waiting for the downsizing. So in men with big median lobes, I might wait even longer, 3, 4 months, 6 months maybe, to see if we can get optimal downsizing before we start.
Oh, wow. So do the like the whole course of ADT almost up front before even starting the radiation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That it gets a little tricky as to, you know, where to draw the line. There do seem to be compelling data that we don't want all of the hormone therapy neoadjuvant. We do want some to come after. And so, you know, in the high-risk patients, for example, I'm comfortable waiting maybe up to 6 months because I know they're going to get more later. But, you know, if that's the way it worked out, somebody's, you know, has an intervening illness or travels or something happens, you know, and the radiation ends up having to be closer to the end of the 6 months, that's appropriate. I mean, that's okay.
Okay.
We want them to be done together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have a couple different types of ADT to choose from, right? We've got our GnRH agonist, most, you know, typically that's, you know, your Lupron, which is an injection. It lasts for 3 months. So if you have somebody who's giving a 4 to 6 month course, I'd imagine they get one injection up front and then another one at 3 months, and it ends up being 6 months. Probably easier to do that than 4 months. And then the other options are your GnRH antagonists, which are typically your pills. These are your relugolixes, you know, yeah. the hard ones to pronounce. Yeah. How do you make a decision which one to give to which patient?
Yeah, I think for the most part, the achieving a castrate level of testosterone seems to be pretty similar, you know, across the different agents. So there, if we're going to choose one or the other, you know, sometimes it's other factors. It's not necessarily what's optimal for achieving castrate levels of testosterone for the purposes of most effectively treating the prostate cancer. You know, as you know, the HERO study suggested that Ergovix or Relugolix has maybe a slightly better cardiac toxicity profile. So that's a consideration where I might, you know, plan to choose that. You know, I think this is something that's also, there's variability in how we address this, but the agonists can cause a testosterone flare effect, right, before you get to castrate levels of testosterone. So sometimes if you want to avoid that, maybe you go with an antagonist instead. So it used to be Degarelix, but now, you know, now it's often Relugolix. And then the kinetics of testosterone suppression and recovery I think maybe sometimes come into play as well. So we've got some candidates, you know, who are maybe borderline in terms of their candidacy for androgen deprivation. So if we want to try it, you know, maybe the more elderly patients to see how they do. But then we also want to have the option of maybe, you know, getting that effect reversed. You know, probably relugolix can achieve that a little bit more quickly than something like, you know, a 3-month injection of an agonist.
So if your patient is really nervous about the side effects of ADT, that's probably better for one of the oral options.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the potential benefits. You know, we're my partner is really studying many of the factors that go into this decision making. Certainly, cardiac stress and toxicity is one of them. But things like this, you know, is there a difference in how the physicians and the patient views the kinetics of testosterone suppression and recovery, and how is that being incorporated into the decision making on the drug that's used? So I think these are all open questions. I see it in the clinic already. And these are things that are being, I think, studied more formally as well. But, you know, clearly the recovery kinetics with the oral agent seems to be faster.
Better. Yeah. Okay, well, let's jump into high risk prostate cancer, what the options are. So it sounds like for intermediate risk, you can do either brachy or EBRT. You can add ADT, maybe yes or no for favorable, typically 4 to 6 months for unfavorable, but you can use these genomic classifiers and AI classifiers to maybe adjudicate those decisions. So that's my quick summary of that.
That's right.
Yeah. So then for high-risk disease, what sort of options are available for those patients?
Yeah. So once we get to high risk, I think, I think for most of us, it now pretty clearly tells us that a longer course of androgen deprivation, again, is likely to lead to a meaningful impact in the rate of distant metastasis, certainly, and maybe prostate cancer-specific survival and overall survival. So most radiation oncologists, I think, are going to be leaning towards a long course of androgen deprivation. Basically, that means 18 up to 24 or 36 months total.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's harder to achieve. You know,
right.
The cumulative side effect of being on ADT for that long, some of the metabolic effects of ADT start to come into play at those longer courses. So it's certainly not without, you know, more risk, and in some cases, subtle risk that you got to be careful about, and be really mindful of. So, you know, there are, again, trials being done looking at can we give less than that in certain more favorable high risk, maybe. But the standard of care, I think, still is 18 to 36 months to go along with, I tell patients, on some good form of radiation that's appropriate for you. And that could be SBRT. That could be, you know, a standard hypofractionated course. Or it could be a combination of brachytherapy and then external beam radiation. We almost never do brachytherapy alone in high-risk cancers.
Got it. So but you can add a brachy boost.
Boost, exactly. Yeah.
And who do you consider more? Is it mostly the oncologic factors that go into that brachy boost, or are there patient or prostate shape factors that go into that?
Yeah, I think it's the same technical factors that I mentioned before for all comers, you know, are important. So a large median lobe is going to, if that's what's present, you're not going to be a candidate for brachy, sort of irregardless of the prostate characteristics, the cancer characteristics. Some men are very motivated to do it. It is possible to do a TURP carefully and then come back and do brachy. So we've done that on occasion for men who are really motivated to do it. I think in general, my view on the literature is sort of the benefit to the patient of a brachy boost scales with the biological aggressiveness. So for the most aggressive cancers, we probably are getting the biggest effect of a brachy boost, meaning brachy boost compared to beam alone, there's probably the largest separation at the Gleason, you know, Gleason 9s and Gleason 10s. And there's probably a group of patients where the distant metastatic risk is so high that maybe it's not worth adding the potential toxicity of brachytherapy. You got to be careful about that. And then as we go from those, you know, the upper end of the high risk spectrum in terms of biological aggressiveness down to the lower end of high risk and then unfavorable intermediate risk as well, you know, that's where maybe the benefit of the brachy is a little bit less, a little bit less, a little bit less. So what I tell patients is, you know, there are good trials across the board that indicate biochemical progression-free survival is improved with a brachy boost in unfavorable intermediate and high-risk prostate cancer. In favorable intermediate-risk prostate cancer, I think we have good data suggesting that brachy alone is just as good as a combination. Then in the highest risk cases, again, the appropriate Gleason 9 and 10s where the competing distant metastasis risk isn't too high, you know, there's a suggestion in some of the literature that maybe this improvement in biochemical progression that we see with brachy might also translate into a lower risk of metastasis eventually and maybe even prostate cancer survival. We've only seen even a hint of that in the highest risk cases. Okay, so that's why I've described this the way I do. And that's how I describe it to patients. You know, what's how much bang for the buck in adding brachy? And then again, it's shared decision making. There's some patients that say, even if you're telling me it adds a little, and I'm going to have to be put to sleep and it might give me a little more immediate urinary irritation, I definitely want to do it. And, you know, that's important to hear that and to make that shared decision together. And so, you know, that's part of it. I think the shared decision making for the appropriate candidates really is a big part of finding the right candidates.
So in modern radiation oncology practice, is that brachy boost typically HDR, LDR, or could it be either one?
It really could be either, you know, and I think what I tell providers and patients, whatever the team is really experienced with and what they do well is going to be the right choice if you're talking about brachy. You certainly don't want me doing an LDR boost at this point because I just haven't done it in so long. HDR, I know well. We do it every day almost. You know, the whole team is very well versed in that, you know, at our institution. But the outcomes in terms of how well, you know, an excellent brachytherapy implant leads to this improvement that we've seen in the literature is independent, really, of whether it's LDR or HDR. I think we view them as equivalent, you know, when done by experienced teams.
Got it. Well, you know, we're getting close to the end of the hour, and I want to be cognizant of your time. I think I may have been a little overambitious wanting to talk about, you know, maybe adjuvant versus salvage and oligometastatic. So perhaps we can, you know, you could come back at some other time and we could chat about that. But before we sign off, I did want to make sure we hit on toxicities and how you counsel patients about short-term versus their long-term risk of toxicities with getting radiation therapy.
Yeah. Great. I think that's very, very important to touch on that. You know, probably similar to you, when you have a discussion about, you know, surgical management, I generally start by talking about the domains that could be impacted when we use radiation. We typically think about three domains. We've touched a little bit already on the urinary domains. So that's certainly one of them. Typically, it's more of an obstructive type problem. Incontinence is exceptionally rare, except maybe for urge incontinence, if the urgency is really what's driving it. You know, and then the obstructive symptoms and the medicines that then may be needed as a result of that and how that might affect your quality of life. Even if it's a grade 2 toxicity, it could be something that you need to just think through what that means. You know, do you walk into a place looking for the bathroom every time to know just where it is?
Right.
You know, that's important for me to at least put that picture in somebody's mind. So urinary is one of them. And really, you know, the main thing is we really don't want to be in a situation where we're at significant risk for a grade 3 or grade 4 toxicity. Yeah, so if there's a high risk of ever needing a catheter or God forbid, a diversion or something like this, I mean, those are cases where I'm going to be counseling patients really to try to find another way in that case. And thankfully, you know, we usually have options. The other main discussion point often, of course, is sexual toxicity. So erectile dysfunction, you know, is a risk of really any treatment we do for prostate cancer except active surveillance. I think that in general, the numbers I keep in my head, something in the ballpark of 30 to 50% chance of erectile dysfunction after radiation. Usually the way I describe it, though, is to say that when I say that, what I mean is maybe it doesn't mean that the erection is completely gone. It's just not as firm as it was prior to treatment. It may not be sufficient for sexual activity, and that we need to, you know, manage that with either with medications or other options that, you know, typically my urology colleagues help with. That one in particular, you know, I think the more we can concentrate the radiation in the prostate, the less we're exposing, you know, the nerve vascular bundles, the veil of Aphrodite, the penile bulb. There's a neurovascular component to how the radiation is causing this problem. You know, we're obviously not cutting anything, so there's still damage that's somehow occurring to either the arterioles that are in blood supply or the nerves themselves. And so the more we concentrate it, the better we get at that. You know, hopefully what we'll see is, you know, a lower risk of toxicity. You know, the historical literature suggests that brachytherapy does have a lower risk of erectile dysfunction. A number of caveats there. Typically, it's a younger man getting brachytherapy, but it is the more focused treatment, you know. So,
right.
You know, so I say maybe, you know, maybe brachy alone is more on the lower end of the spectrum of those numbers I gave. And then, you know, beam and combination is at maybe more the upper end of the spectrum. And then the last domain is bowel function. So when I say that, you know, I think, again, historically, what we used to really worry about is rectal injury, rectal bleeding, you know, proctitis that required laser coagulation. Thankfully, we do not see that much anymore. And it's not really related to rectal spacers, with or without a spacer. You know, we really just don't see radiation proctitis very much, certainly not at the numbers we used to. So I used to tell patients, you know, even just 10 years ago, I used to tell patients, yeah, the risk is maybe 10-15%. And now, you know, really certainly not seeing numbers that high. I think it's probably much closer to 2-5%, maybe even less than that. The rectal spacers have helped some, but we've just gotten better at, you know, how the radiation is designed. We've learned what might, you know, promote that kind of a problem. So, you know, that's improved a lot. So nowadays, the GI toxicity, maybe that we see a little bit more, is bowel frequency, bowel urgency, diarrhea. So that's the other one that we sometimes talk about. We don't see it too much when we treat just the prostate. You know, at that time, it's really just, you know, that adjacent rectum that can get a little bit of radiation exposure. You know, as you know, there's some controversy as to should we really irradiate prophylactically the pelvic lymph nodes?
Yeah, we haven't even gotten into that yet.
About to add today, but hey, that's a whole hour by itself.
Love to save that for another time.
But when we do that, certainly the exposure to the intestines and the rest of the colon, you know, increases, and that increases the risk of grade 2 GI toxicities, which manifest as bowel urgency or frequency. So you sometimes talk about that, and that may be one of the situations where proton beam, you know, could reduce the risk of a GI toxicity because we eliminate some of that scatter exposure in the intestine.
Got it. For lymph nodes specifically, because I know there's some controversy whether or not proton versus photon when it comes, whether that the juice is worth the squeeze there.
That's right. That's fair. I think, you know, when we're treating a larger target, when we include the lymph nodes, you know, I think we might start to see a little bit more of a difference there.
Got it. And then just quickly on the timeline for the sexual dysfunction, what timeline does that happen on? Is that, you know, kind of acutely right away that they'll start noticing that? Or is that side effects that start showing up like years down the road?
Yeah, it's not right away. You know, many of these patients are on ADT. So, of course, they usually have sexual dysfunction from that. When their testosterone recovers, if they've taken ADT or immediately after radiation, you know, typically, we won't see a significant change in erectile function right away. I would say in men who go on to develop erectile dysfunction, I start to hear some questions about it at the 6 to 9 month type of a range. You know, at the 2 year mark, let's say, I think that's really kind of, I tell people, this is probably where you're going to be at this point. You know, in 2 years, we're probably not going to see too much more change.
So they stabilize at 2 years.
Yeah. So if they have good function for a year or two after radiation, you know, at that point, I would say, yes, there are other causes for erectile dysfunction. At this point, I don't think the radiation's contributing anymore. You know, it's likely the other potentially modifiable factors. But it can be sort of a slow and steady decline over up to about 2 years. And that's the time point that we actually measure at when we report numbers, like the numbers I sent earlier. It's really at that 2 year time point. Whereas with surgery, maybe it's a little bit different than that, where
right.
recovery. So we try to kind of wash that out and look at the 2 year time point so that we really can make a fair comparison.
Well, Dr. Patel, I think we could probably keep talking for like another hour about radiation therapy and prostate cancer, but I know you have to go. So I just want to say thank you so much for contributing to the podcast. I think everybody is going to learn a lot from this episode.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm happy to come back anytime if you want to touch on some of these other interesting topics as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Have a great day, Dr. Patel.
Take care. You too.